This podcast is, of course, made possible through the support of our members and from Dartmouth Hitchcock. Imagine nationally ranked healthcare in your community with convenient locations throughout northern New England. World-class providers are closer than you think. Visit dartmouthhitchcock.org to learn more. Dartmouth Hitchcock is here.
And the Dagoba Group, a global diversity and inclusion consulting practice with specialties in unconscious bias, leadership dynamics, and client engagement. Authors of the book, The Inclusion Dividend. More at thedagobagroup.com.
And Northeast Credit Union, helping their members save money through free checking accounts and refinancing of auto, home, and personal loans. Northeast Credit Union, encouraging you to discover the difference at necu.org. Federally insured by NCUA, equal housing opportunity.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. After 5 years of statewide debate, the Northern Pass hydropower project is in a new phase that could finally lead to a conclusion. An appointed panel called the Site Evaluation Committee is reviewing all the details and all the commentary about the project, and what a lot of commentary there is. More than 150 requests came in from those wanting to be so-called interveners in the process, meaning their hopes and concerns would be officially addressed. The committee told more than 100 yes, but the way their voices will be heard is also causing some consternation. It's a lot to wade through, but the outcome matters a ton for those people and communities directly affected, and really for the entire state. Today in The Exchange, reviewing Northern Pass, let's hear from you. What do you think this committee should consider as it prepares to say yes or no to this project? The Exchange number is 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange@nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. We have three guests for the hour. Dave Solomon is here, reporter for the New Hampshire Union Leader and Sunday News. Dave is author of the column Power Plays, which covers energy issues in the state. And Dave, thank you so much for being here.
Glad to be here, Laura.
Also with us, Tom Irwin, Vice President and Director of the Conservation Law Foundation, New Hampshire, which opposes Northern Pass and is involved as an intervener. And Tom, good to see you. Thank you for being here.
My pleasure. Glad to be here.
Also with us, Mark Brown, President of the New England Ratepayers Association, which is in favor of Northern Pass. And Mark Brown, good to meet you. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, Laura. Thanks for having me.
Well, and Dave, let's just remind people where we are at. First off, how big this project is, both physically and in terms of how much electricity it would produce.
Well, about 10 years ago, as best as we can guess, Hydro-Quebec and then Public Service of New Hampshire began negotiations about a deal that would enable Hydro-Quebec to sell some of these large surplus of hydroelectricity it's generating into the New England market. It's already a substantial player. We already get about 2,000 megawatts from Hydro-Quebec from various lines that already exist, and they have plenty of energy to sell. And PSNH has an existing transmission right-of-way through most of New Hampshire, so they thought it would be a pretty simple deal to expand that right-of-way to accommodate additional transmission from Quebec. The problem has the largest problem being there's 40 miles from the New Hampshire border with Canada to where the existing right-of-way starts that they needed to create a new right-of-way. Since the project was formally proposed in 2011, creating that link through the 40 miles in the northernmost part of the state from the Canadian border to where Public Service already has a transmission right away has been the most contentious problem in getting the project approved. In the earlier phases, the project sponsors focused mostly on buying land in that 40-mile area that they could own and then create a right of way. They were unable to put a right-of-way together that way because opponents blocked their move by purchasing or land in their way, in essence. The Society for the Protection of New Hampshire Forests stepped in and obtained easements in land that the utility needed to create that new right-of-way. So about 2 years ago, they decided to abandon that route and came up with a new one.
There's been a number of shifting routes over the years.
About 8 miles of burial through that 40-mile zone. And more recently, they came up with even additional burial through the White Mountain National Forest. So now they're burying about 60 miles, 8 miles in that northernmost section by the Canadian border, and then another 42 or so, or near
so,
the
So, Dave, just for people who
forest.
Haven't been paying as much attention as you have been, and we have been here on The Exchange, you know, how big is this? I mean, is it a lot of electricity? Is this going to radically change the amount of, you know, non-fossil
sure.
fuel-based power in the state? How visible would this project be? I mean, I'm just trying to get a sense of how significant this is for New Hampshire.
If built, you'd have 192 miles of transmission towers running from the Canadian border to a substation in Deerfield, 190 miles through New Hampshire and through the heart of the White Mountain
National
Forest.
So that's a long stretch.
It's a long stretch, and it's the tall towers you see near the turnpike exits and places like that, not the little wooden ones that are distribution. So 192 miles of large transmission line right through the center of New Hampshire, basically from the Canadian border to Deerfield, pumping about 1,000 megawatts of hydroelectricity from Quebec into that substation at Deerfield and into the rest of the New England grid. That is almost the size of the Seabrook Nuclear Power Plant, which generates about 1,200. So building the line would be the equivalent of adding a new substantial power plant to the New England grid. And at a time when a lot of the old coal-fired and nuclear power plants are retiring, creating a source of energy equivalent to the construction of a new power plant without actually building a new power plant is probably one of the most attractive selling points of the project.
So a shifting energy landscape here in New Hampshire, and backers of this project are trying to figure out where it fits in. And Tom Renner, I want to turn to you next. You know, Dave mentioned the timeline, and he's absolutely right. People have been talking about this for a long time. It was unveiled about 5 years ago by then Governor Lynch to a lot of cheering, but the cheering kind of died away pretty quickly. Why are we still talking about this after 5 years?
We're talking about this because it is a significant project. It's one that will have a major impact on communities really down the heart, down the spine of New Hampshire. And, you know, there are significant questions about whether this project is needed. And I will just say from Conservation Law Foundation's perspective, we consider this project to be wrong for New Hampshire and wrong for New England because Northern Pass has not made the case that in terms of our regional energy needs, this project is necessary. And even if it were, it really has not addressed the overriding, overwhelming concerns that so many communities and people in New Hampshire have about the land-based impacts of this project, which will be significant.
Land-based impacts meaning the towers?
The towers, viewshed impacts, impacts on property rights, on a tourism economy. You know, there are projects elsewhere in New England, and this gets to the point of need. There are projects elsewhere in New England proposing to bring the same amount, essentially, of Canadian hydropower or Canadian power into New England. And we need to think about this in terms of the New England grid, not New Hampshire, in terms of energy consumption, because much of this energy will be consumed south of New Hampshire, Massachusetts, Connecticut, Rhode Island. But in any event, other projects propose to bring equivalent amounts of power into the New England grid with much less or essentially no impact on communities by burying their transmission lines. So what we're seeing in New Hampshire is essentially outdated technology, overhead massive HVDC lines that could be undergrounded to avoid the significant controversy involved with this project.
And we'll definitely talk a little bit more, Tom, about overhead, underground, especially in light of a Vermont project that is being, I think, 100% buried, also hydropower. But I did want to fold you in as well, Mark Brown. Why do you think this has been such a long, difficult process?
Well, I think Tom hit some points. You know, it's landowners that are, you know, worried about seeing transmission lines. I think the bigger issue is, you know, we need the power. 25% of our generation capacity is either retired or retiring in the future, and we need new baseload supply to replace that. You know, policies of the past have kind of led us down this road where right now I think we're only looking at natural gas and large-scale hydro for future baseload power. We're not going to build any new coal plants. We're not going to build any new oil plants. Nuclear plants are retiring. So, you know, we really need to look at large-scale hydro. Tom mentioned the New England Clean Power Link in Vermont, and it's not a zero-sum game. It's not, well, we need this project or this one. You know, we need them both, and we're going to need it all.
So you're talking about, again, that shifting energy picture that Dave Solomon talked about. You know, Vermont Yankee is closing. Coal plants are being shut down.
Pilgrim.
And so you got to get it. You got to get it somewhere. How do you think the opposition has approached this, Mark? The idea that, you know, hydropower, fine, but the way that this project has been envisioned is ugly and will hurt a tourism economy. I wonder how you feel about that.
Well, I think the bigger picture is what would happen. Let's say the project doesn't get built because of opposition. Let's say we don't bring in additional resources. Let's say electricity rates continue to be volatile, the volatility continues. What happens if large manufacturers leave? Then what happens to property rights in those areas and the jobs and the, you know, the downstream economic impacts? So it's, I don't think it's just as simple to say, well, we're worried about towers impacting, you know, views and tourism and that sort of thing. There's a bigger picture here than just the towers.
There's been a criticism, too, and I want to ask everybody, but I'll turn to you first, Mark, that, you know, obviously there are concerns about the project that Tom mentioned, but people, Mark, have also said the process hasn't been well done, that Northern Pass officials could have done a better job presenting the plan, planning for the plan, reaching out to opponents beforehand. Is part of this, Mark, about the project itself, but part of it is about how it's been handled?
I'm sure that's part of it. I'm sure they could have done things better, but you could probably say that about any project. You know, we're seeing that with, you know, the Kinder Morgan pipeline project. They probably could have done a better job rolling that out as well. But that doesn't, you know, change the need for the project.
Mark, excuse me, Dave, what do you think?
Well, I think the biggest evidence to the proposition that the way the project has been presented was perhaps part of its problems in the earlier phase is the way the presentation has changed so significantly in recent years and the way Public Service now Eversource has modified the project in recent years. What started out as a project with no burial and a sense that we own almost all of the right-of-way we need, it's just an extra 40 miles, and there was even some fear that eminent domain might be involved, that has changed substantially in the ensuing 5 years. The legislature passed a law that would prohibit eminent domain. The company was unable to buy the necessary properties. Eventually, they took a more conciliatory approach and agreed to bury some more of the line, although not as much as would be preferred by many of the opponents, and introduced a $200 million economic development fund in an attempt to win the hearts and minds of the people, particularly in that most critical 40-mile zone along the Canadian border that is very economically depressed. So the new CEO of Eversource, Mr. Quinlan, under his leadership, they have taken a different approach, and they've brought the project finally to the SEC, the Site Evaluation Committee, with an accepted of an application late last year.
Well, and we'll spend a lot of time talking about that site evaluation committee process and so forth and hear about people involved. But, Tom, I'd like to hear from you, too. I mean, is the problem partly the project itself and some of the concerns you mentioned, but also just how this has been handled?
I think it's largely the project itself. And I think, you know, one thing that's been remarkable to observe here is this process has been playing out over, you know, 5+ years. Since an application was first filed for federal permitting authority. And what's been remarkable is how effectively the opposition has remained engaged. Often it's a challenge for everyday people to remain engaged in processes that play out over years. And they have certainly done so here. And I think one thing that's important to emphasize, you know, Dave mentioned a lot of the opposition coming from the northernmost part of the project. There is very substantial opposition in Deerfield at the southernmost portion of the project.
It isn't just in northern New Hampshire like we're
exactly.
often
Exactly. In Concord. You know, Concord has intervened in the SEC proceeding, for example. And Concord, by the way, in terms of viewshed impacts, is considered to be one of, if not the most affected communities.
By the way, if anybody wants to take a look at the proposal, what it would do in New Hampshire, where that line goes, we've got a map on our website. It's nhpr.org/exchange. Again, nhpr.org/exchange. And we'd love to hear from you this hour as we look at where the Northern Pass Project is at this point. It's been a while since we checked in on this. And the project, as we're hearing, has entered a review phase from the Site Evaluation Committee. We'll find out what that's all about. But let's hear from you, too. The exchange number, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. As this Site Evaluation Committee reviews the project, what do you think it should consider? Again, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Our guests are Dave Solomon. He's a reporter for the New Hampshire Union Leader and Sunday News, author of the column Power Plays, which covers energy issues. Also with us, Tom Irwin, Vice President and Director of the Conservation Law Foundation, New Hampshire, and Mark Brown, President of the New England Ratepayers Association. Again, 1-800-892-6477. And guys, you know, as this proposal has gone through the process and we've had all this debate over the many years, as you all have said, a lot of people, Dave, have said, okay, the Site Evaluation Committee is going to have to ultimately take a look at this. Who is the Site Evaluation Committee?
Well, it's sort of like a statewide planning board for large-scale energy projects. Somebody has to review the plans, make sure they are compliant with the state's regulations for land use in many respects and so forth. So this has been a panel that's existed for years. Until more recently, it was comprised largely of the representatives or commissioners of the key planning departments in the state, economic resources and development, environmental protection, and so forth, and as well as the members of the Public Utilities Commission, officialdom, as it were.
Yeah.
The laws,
state officials who would have some expertise and interest.
Expertise and interest and authority.
Mm-hmm.
Largely due to the Northern Pass proposal, there was a very aggressive effort made to change the composition of the SEC about 2 years ago, and to get citizen representatives on the panel, and to introduce criteria regarding a public benefit of a project. It wouldn't, in other words, not enough that it just doesn't cause harm. It has to actually provide significant benefit. And other rules were changed in ways that were perceived as benefiting in some ways opponents of the Northern Pass. Although they didn't get everything they wanted. The ultimate rules change and the way the board composition of the board was changed was seen as a compromise, and that's the board that's now going to review the project.
Mark, how much trust is there among supporters and opponents of the Northern Pass Project that this is a good way to do it, that this Site Evaluation Committee, you know, is set up in a way that will review this project fairly? This is not a personal knock on anybody in the committee, but do folks feel like, yeah, this is an okay way to review a project of this magnitude?
Well, I think it's split, but I think it's the process that we have. You know, we went through the SB 99, SB 245 processes to review the Site Evaluation Committee.
Those were bills in the Senate.
They were.
That's okay.
And Jonathan Rabb was brought in to, you know, kind of review the process, see what would be, you know, the best avenue to take, how to proceed, how to develop the SEC process, the membership, the composition of the membership, drafting new rules, which recently happened, which was recently accepted by JLCAR. And that's where we're at now.
What's JLCAR?
Joint Legislative Committee on Administrative Rules. Basically the legislature has to approve rules for agencies. So.
What do you think, Tom? How do you feel about this sort of body, the way it was changed, as Dave described, and whether this is the right way to review a project of this size?
Well, I think, first of all, there are two processes in play. So there is the Site Evaluation Committee, and I just want to mention the fact that at the federal level, there is additional process. The
Department Very important of, point, yes.
Right,
the Department, this isn't the end-all, be-all.
Exactly. The Department of Energy will have to determine whether or not to grant a presidential permit. So at the federal level, there's been a lot of environmental review and analyses. There is a public comment process in play there in which we're very much engaged. I think the Site Evaluation Committee, you know, as Mark said, it's the system we have. There are roughly 130 interveners, so it will certainly be a challenge in terms of managing the process. But we expect that it will address the key issues.
Well, and coming up, we'll talk to some of those interveners, and including you, Tom, and your group, but some other folks as well. And we'll start taking your questions and comments, so stay with us. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, where the Northern Pass Project stands and what might be next in the approval process. Let's hear from you. Your questions and comments are welcome at 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. Send email to exchange@nhpr.org. Post a comment on our Facebook page. By the way, if you want to see a picture of the latest proposed route from Northern Pass, we've put it on our website. That's nhpr.org/exchange. Again, nhpr.org/exchange. Our guests are Dave Solomon. He's a reporter for the New Hampshire Union Leader. His column is Power Plays, covering energy issues. Tom Irwin's here with the Conservation Law Foundation, and Mark Brown with the New England Ratepayers Association. And gentlemen, let's go to the phones. And Lisa's joining us from Deerfield. Hi, Lisa. Go ahead. You're on The Exchange. Welcome.
Hi, Laura. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I'm just calling to make a couple of comments. My husband and I have two properties. One is in Deerfield and one is in Easton. Now, my husband has been to meetings all throughout, up everywhere, Concord, Deerfield, up north. And we understand that the first pass is going to be underground, which is better, but unfortunately it's going to go right in front of our driveway up there, so we're going to have issues trying to get into our driveway. Deerfield, you know, that's a different story with those stupid towers. But the other fact is that because Jim's been such an opponent, he applied for intervener status, and they denied it.
Oh, okay. So intervener status, again, we haven't quite talked about this, Lisa, but that means you are officially heard by the site evaluation committee, so
yes,
to speak.
You have to be accepted.
Yeah. Well, Lisa, I'm glad you called, because Dave Solomon, I did want to ask you specifically about Deerfield. I mean, that's the end of the line, and they've got some special concerns there.
Well, I think everyone along the line particularly has got concerns, because they're going to see construction and larger widening of the right-of-way, and in many cases, larger towers than what's there now. And in Deerfield, they've got probably a lot of more construction involved in upgrading the station where all of this electricity is going to end up and be converted for transmission into the New England grid. So I think the concerns are the same along the line, the difference being in most of the southern sections, these are places that are already along a transmission right-of-way, not looking out at virgin forest.
Well, and she mentioned she and her husband wanted to be interveners in this process. And without getting too geeky in terms of what does that mean, Dave, why is that important?
Well, because it gives you official standing in the process. You are formally notified as to every turn of the screw as motions are filed and developments occur and events are scheduled. You have the right to file formal written testimony, verbal testimony, and what you have to say has to be taken under consideration as a formal part of the process.
And Mark, your group, the New England Ratepayers Association, asked also to be interveners and was denied. Why do you suppose that's the case, and how do you feel about it?
Well, we were not happy about it, but we were denied along with a lot of other businesses and business groups, BAE, Dine, Wilcox. So I guess the general argument was that the overall process would look out for ratepayers. So, you know, of course, we would like to have been an intervener, but we understand that there's no way they can let everybody intervene. It would just be too unwieldy at that point.
What was the case that you would have made if you were allowed to?
Well, the case that we would make is that, you know, we need to bring in new power to reduce rates. You know, we've had a lot of volatility in the marketplace. We haven't even seen what the impact of the capacity markets are going to have on us. There's a bunch of different markets, but, you know, we pay for capacity and energy. And, you know, right now, the last year, you know, was about $5.1 billion total energy market cost. Okay. New Hampshire pays about 10% of that, so say $500 million. In the future, our capacity payments alone are going to increase by, say, $150 to $200 million due to the increase in capacity costs, you know, from the four capacity auctions.
Capacity cost means exactly what?
We pay generators just to be on, just to be available. Just to,
I see. Even if we're not using it.
Even if we're not using them. So it's based on their, you know, on their size, and they get payments based on that. So, you know, like this year, I think we're looking at $1.5 billion. In future years, the capacity market is going to increase to $3 billion and then $4 billion. Before it slides back down to $3 billion. So we haven't even seen those in our electricity rates yet, those increases.
What guarantee is there, Mark, and then Tom, I want to hear from you too, that if this came online, this Northern Pass project, that rates would go down?
Well, the capacity, I think it's safe to say the capacity rates would go down. I mean, you're adding capacity, so that would definitely happen. As far as energy rates go, it's a supply and demand issue. You have more supply, you're going to reduce the cost. How significantly? No project is going to have a dramatic impact on everybody's electricity rates. But it's the cumulative effect. You know, if you can get Northern Pass and then, you know, pipeline to continue to bring cheap gas in. You know, if we don't – if the price of gas goes up, you know, we've been lucky. We've seen, you know, low gas prices the last couple of years. And – this past year especially, we had a mild winter, which, you know, reduced rates. We're not going to see that. We've seen volatility in the past. 2012, we had really low wholesale rates. And then the next two winters, we spiked, and that kind of brought the furor of, you know, what's going on with businesses. So we could see that again. There's no guarantee that we're going to continue to see the low wholesale rates that we did this past winter.
And, Tom, I know you expressed concerns earlier that New England doesn't need this project. But as Dave and Mark have mentioned, you know, Vermont Yankee's closing down. The Southern New Hampshire pipeline was taken off the table. Coal plants are being shut down. And I'm just familiar with what's happening here in New Hampshire, never mind all of New England. So if this is not approved, does that kind of leave us with higher rates in the future, as Mark is worried about?
No, not necessarily. And I think Mark is right to be expanding the lens and looking at the larger energy picture. That's what we've been saying for some time we need to do. We should not be looking at this project outside of the larger context. And if you look at the larger energy context,
here in New England.
In New England, yes. You have to look at energy efficiency. So in terms of energy efficiency, we have kept electric demand essentially flat as a result of progress being made on energy efficiency. And ISO New England, which manages the New England electric grid, predicts that energy efficiency will more than double by the year 2024 to the tune of 3,600 megawatts of energy avoided. You also have to look at renewables and progress we can and should be making on that front. There are 4,200 megawatts worth of wind projects proposed.
Although those have a hard time. Those have just as hard a time as hydro.
They can. But, you know, there's certainly a lot of growing interest in offshore wind, which has real potential in New England. And then, of course, solar, which has been getting a lot more attention. There are goals to achieve 2,400 megawatts of installed solar in the next 8 years. So there are a lot of moving parts here. And there are projects that are proposing to import hydropower, but pairing that import with wind and other renewables. And what we have in the Northern Pass project is just big hydro. And there are impacts associated with big hydro. This is not impact-free power. The scale of what's done in northern Canada for purposes of constructing these reservoirs is really – it's hard to fathom. It's nothing we would ever see in New England. The reengineering of natural ecosystems to build these massive reservoirs, which in turn – emit greenhouse gases.
So there's some releases of carbon when you dam things up and right. Change the vegetation in the whole ecosystem.
Yes. You lose the carbon sink of the forest, and then when you inundate, there is an off-gassing of greenhouse gases for a period of time.
We've been talking about interveners in this process. As it is now before the Site Evaluation Committee, after a lot of debate leading up to this point, joining us now is someone who is involved as an intervener representing six towns opposed to Northern Pass. Christine Fillmore is with us. She's legal counsel for Bristol, Franconia, Sugar Hill, Whitefield, Northumberland, and Easton. And Christine Fillmore, good to have you. Thank you for your time.
Thanks very much for having me.
Well, you represent 6 towns in this process. How different are the concerns among these towns that they're bringing to the table?
Well, we have 3 towns in an overhead, in different overhead areas, and 3 towns in the proposed buried areas. And they have share some of the same concerns, and they have some different concerns, obviously. The main concern for all of these towns is that, as with any large energy project, the decision-making process is out of their hands. Towns generally can control how land is used in their town, how development proceeds, but when it involves a large energy project, obviously, they don't have that control anymore. The state has control over that. So their concern is, how will this proposed project impact what's going on in their town? And in the overhead areas, aesthetics are obviously the biggest issue. How is it going to look? Will there be audio impacts, environmental impacts on wetlands and habitat, and the impact of all of those things on the tourism economy and the quality of life in those areas? And in the buried areas, there are also environmental concerns with water bodies, wetlands, and habitats, since the line is proposed to be buried 3 to 6 feet below the surface. So that's pretty shallow. And with that, there are a lot of technical challenges they're concerned about. If the line is buried, it's a high-voltage transmission line buried 3 to 6 feet below the surface, and if a town needs to run, say, a water line near or perpendicular to that transmission line, the town would have to bore down well beneath the transmission line, which will cost a lot more than it ordinarily would. And in the future, there may be disruption during construction, but towns are also concerned about future disruptions when repairs to buried lines are needed.
So, Christine, you're representing these 6 towns, and as you've described, they've got some different concerns. How do they feel about being lumped together as one in terms of making their presentation to the Site Evaluation Committee?
That's a very good question. Our 6 towns are not all in one group. The Site Evaluation Committee has split the intervening municipalities into several different groups.
Right, with different concerns.
It was originally 3 groups, and now it's 5 groups. So overhead towns are generally together, and the buried towns are together. So my firm is working with several different municipal intervening groups. But even within those groups, because they only include either overhead or buried, even within those groups, there are some concerns about how to work together, because we haven't gotten clarity yet from the committee about exactly how the groups are supposed to work. And part of that is just that this is such a large and complex project and it has so many moving parts and so many people involved and different parties that we're still waiting for some orders to come from the Site Evaluation Committee to explain exactly how these groups are supposed to work. In the meantime, what we've been trying to do is to work with at least one representative from each municipality within those small intervener municipality groups.
Wow, it's complicated, Christine, isn't it?
It really is. And some of them have attorneys working with them, and some of them don't. And when you're talking about a municipality, if they don't have an attorney representing them for this, that means generally that the Board of Selectmen has to make all of the decisions, and they can only do that at a public meeting, and they don't meet every day.
So right, and they're volunteers too, some of them.
Very difficult.
Sure.
Yes.
Well, so let me pull out then from this complicated process before the Site Evaluation Committee and just ask you a broader question. If I could, Christine, you know, as you know, towns have rejected wind farms, and a fight just recently ended in southern New Hampshire over a pipeline and so forth. If towns keep saying no to this and no to that, where does the energy come from, especially the renewable energy that everybody says they want?
Well, I don't think that any of the towns that I'm working with, anyway, are opposed in concept to the idea. Particularly with this project, some of the concern in the overhead towns has been that if we can bury it in some portions, why can't the whole thing be buried? So they're concerned that that option has not been fully explored. And in the towns where the project would be buried, there's also a concern that there are alternative routes that have not really been considered or worked on. In the state of Maine, for instance, they have a very large transmission project that's running down the interstate. And so there's some concern among our towns about why the applicants haven't looked at that in New Hampshire. And if they have they looked at it closely enough?
Okay, and that's
because
been a longstanding
a corridor.
Issue. Yeah.
Yeah, that's a corridor that would have a minimal impact on the town. So it's not in opposition to power altogether.
It's the way that this has been done. Okay. Christine, thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you.
That's Christine Fillmore again, legal counsel for six towns opposed to Northern Pass, talking about her hopes for this intervener process before the Site Evaluation Committee. Joining us now is someone else who was approved as an intervener in this process. Brian Murphy is on the line, business manager for Local 104 of the IBEW, the Electrical Workers Union, which is in favor of Northern Pass. And Brian Murphy, welcome to you.
Well, thank you for having me.
Why does the IBEW support Northern Pass? What does it do for your members?
Well, for number one, it's jobs for New Hampshire. You're talking a lot of jobs. I think the study was 2,600 jobs altogether. That is not just all IBEW jobs. That is pretty much every industry in New Hampshire, whether it be truck driving, hardware stores, hotels. There's a lot that has to be done with getting all these members out there working and fed.
Some people have said, sure, there'll be jobs, but there'll be temporary jobs. How do you feel about that, Brian?
Well, in the construction industry, and that's what we are with Local 104, we are in construction. And it is temporary jobs for everything we do, but everything we leave behind leave some permanent jobs. This is, I believe this is the second largest job in New Hampshire ever proposed, the largest being Seabrook. And there were a lot of permanent jobs left with that. Fire, police, there was a lot.
So activity around the line even after it's built, maintaining it and so forth.
Absolutely. I'm sure that Eversource would be looking to hire permanent employees. I can't really speak for them, but I know the industry. They would have to.
You know, Brian, there are a lot of interveners in this process, a lot more people who wanted to be interveners, but you guys were lucky enough to be given a yes by the Site Evaluation Committee. A lot of interveners on the list, though, are opposed to this project. How are you guys at the IBEW going to make your voices heard?
Well, for one, I think we represent a large number of New Hampshire workers that are able to perform that work. We presently have about 500 between Local 104 and 490 from New Hampshire alone. And we represent well over 1,500 in the general area. So with just having the manpower and the knowledge for that type of job gives us the opportunity, I think, of why we're being heard.
How hopeful are you, Brian, that this thing will actually be built?
I'm really hopeful it will be built because I'm looking forward to get some of my own members home. We've had guys that have done line work in New Hampshire lived in New Hampshire but have never worked in New Hampshire for some 30 years.
Oh, because they have to go elsewhere for work.
That's correct.
Okay. Well, Brian, thank you for being with us.
All right.
Bye-bye.
Thank you.
That's Brian Murphy, again, business manager for Local 104 of the IBEW and another one of the interveners in this Site Evaluation Committee process, now reviewing the Northern Pass. When we come back, more of your phone calls at 1-800-892-6477. I also have a stack of emails that I'll share with you gentlemen here in studio. Again, you can join us with an email, exchange@nhpr.org, or give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, where the state approval process for Northern Pass stands right now and what might be next. Let's hear from you. The Exchange number, 1-800-892-6477. 1-800-892-NHPR. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. newhampshire.org. With me in studio, Dave Solomon, reporter for the New Hampshire Union Leader and Sunday News, author of the column Power Plays, which covers energy. Tom Irwin is here, vice president and director of the Conservation Law Foundation, New Hampshire. And Mark Brown, president of the New England Ratepayers Association. One more time, the exchange number is 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. And gentlemen, I want to read a couple emails and get your thoughts, if I could, please. And here's one from Frank in Manchester, who says, like all projects of major scope and complexity, Northern Pass will have to address the concerns of a diverse roster of stakeholders and constituents. The new plan has addressed, to a significant degree, many of the issues while providing some much-needed relief to ratepayers and diversifying the region's energy portfolio. Frank says, if we choose to wait until a perfect solution can be found, I'm concerned that it will never happen. Now is the time, Frank says, for this important project. And so, Tom, I'll throw that one to you first. No, it's not perfect, but if we wait for the perfect, it'll never be found. What do you think?
Again, we would suggest that we need to look at this on a larger scale, on the region-wide scale. And, you know, as mentioned earlier, there are three other projects proposed to bring equivalent amounts of hydropower, or not just hydropower, but power, down from the north. All of them without the impacts associated with Northern Pass, all of them proposing to bury their transmission. So it's not as if this is the only project out there, and if it doesn't happen, we're in trouble. That is just not the case.
It's a little more complicated than that sort of A or B and no other. There's no other C. Dave, can you jump in on this as well?
Well, I think it's true, as Tom says. There's no one disputes that some additional sources of power would be beneficial in the long run, particularly if we can get more renewable. But the Northern Pass is not the one and only solution. There's also the fact that the region has a very robust mechanism for generating new regional infrastructure when the operator of the New England grid has determined that that infrastructure is necessary to keep the grid functioning, to keep the grid reliable, to keep the lights on, to in effect ensure that we have enough energy and it can be delivered. And the operator of the New England grid has never decided or that Northern Pass is a reliability project. Eversource is in the middle of two large-scale transmission projects, the Merrimack Valley Reliability Project and the Seacoast Reliability Project, both of which have had some hurdles and have met some public opposition but are pretty much on path for construction because they are widely viewed as necessary for the stability of the grid. That argument has never been made for Northern Pass. It's a merchant project. It's being developed by Public Service and its partner Hydro-Quebec so that Hydro-Quebec can make money selling electricity into New England and so that Northern Pass can – and so that Eversource can make money charging Hydro-Quebec rent for the use of its right-of-way. That's the business reason they're doing it.
That's what a merchant project means.
It's just a merchant project. It's in their business interest, the argument being it's also in the interest of consumers, and that's what's in debate.
Well, and is that a fair argument? I mean, Mark, that's the case that you've been making that, you know, maybe this benefits Eversource and Hydro-Quebec, sure, but it also benefits New Hampshire.
Well, and it does, and it will. You know, I mentioned natural gas prices earlier. You know, the higher natural gas prices go, the higher the marginal rate of electricity will go, and the more benefits we will see from the Northern Pass project, which will, you know, mitigate some of that. But also keep in mind that when ISO rules about reliability, they don't consider costs. They don't consider costs to consumers. They just want to make sure they keep the lights on. It doesn't matter to them if they're running, you know, diesel generators as long as the lights are run. You know, I mean, as long as the lights are kept on. So I think it's – while it's true that Northern Pass is not a reliability project, keep in mind that ISO doesn't think about costs when it comes to reliability. So businesses, they care about costs.
Let's go to some more callers, gentlemen. Again, the number 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. And from Atkinson, Donald is on the line. Hi, Donald. Go ahead.
Yes. Seems to be missing from this discussion is FERC and the critical energy infrastructure information classification that closes dockets and reports. And particularly, there's two reports at ISO New England that I'd like to read to see if this project is actually needed.
So, Donald, you're saying the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission is also an important part of this.
Yeah, I mean, part of this classification means that you can't get transmission line maps. The state legislatures, you know, get them handed out at the beginning of the meeting and then collected. They can't take them home and study them.
So there's a fair bit of secrecy, Dave Solomon, that he's saying has been involved in this process. Without addressing the specifics, you do hear from critics that, you know, there hasn't been enough above board, enough information. People have talked behind closed doors and so forth. I think
most
of jump in on that.
Detail regarding the proposal is available in the filings on the website of the Public Utilities Commission and the Federal Emergency Regulatory Commission. So I'm not sure what maps or illustrations have been kept confidential.
All right, Donald. Well, thank you for calling in. And let's go to Hollis, where John is on the line. Hi, John. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi. How are you?
I'm fine, John. Go ahead.
Good. Hi. I had a couple of comments. Firstly, I heard Christine Fillmore, legal counsel for various towns. She had voiced some concerns of the buried utility people with the future conflicts. To me, it's real simple. Just place some sleeving every half mile or so where the towns want to put their water lines, and they've solved their problems. They have to do this up front, and they have to ask the utility company to pay for it. Secondly, Brian Murphy said there's a ton of jobs coming in for this. We're all for the lot of jobs. If you bury the whole line, you'd have even more jobs. But he should be on board with this. One of the things I'd like everybody
to be on board with burial, you mean, John, huh?
Yeah, with burial, okay. There's more jobs.
Sure.
There's more work. More jobs. Everybody's happy in the state for that. But one of the things we've got to remember, the site selection committee talks about how the people of New Hampshire, northern New Hampshire, have remained engaged for 5 years and how astounding it is. One of the things you have to remember is we've remained engaged for more than 35 years. Back in the 1970s, the same proposal went in front of the state, and it was rejected. And it was, it was withdrawn without prejudice because it was going to be rejected. And other parts of this whole project that weren't so volatile were built upon and pushed and were approved. And all that was left was this little area, which is very important viewscape, a very important area in New Hampshire that's left over.
Let's talk about the burial.
And for its own. Pardon me?
I do want to talk about the burial. I'm glad you raised it, John, and thank you for calling in. So, gentlemen, there are a lot of people who say, look, if you just buried this thing, I wouldn't have any problem with it. Tom, how do you feel? I mean, if many opponents say, you know, just bury it, would that be satisfactory to you? Would that sort of wipe away your concerns about this project?
Well, again, we would go back to how does this fit into the larger energy picture for New England?
And do we need it? Buried or not?
Does it make sense? I mean, one concern with too much power coming down from Canada is, are we then undermining the development of clean, renewable energy in New England? And again, that gets back to my point that large-scale, big hydro in Canada is not impact-free. I mean, very little energy is impact-free, but the scale of impact associated with big hydro is significant, and it's important to note that, you know, big hydro does not qualify, for example, with as renewable energy within New Hampshire's renewable energy portfolio laws. And there's a reason for that. It's because of the impact.
So it isn't, for you, it isn't just about burying the line. It's about concerns that hydro really isn't that green, and we shouldn't dump all our eggs in that basket, so to
speak. We should not dump all our eggs in that basket. There is a role for hydro, but we need to be careful and thoughtful about it. And to your question, if the line were buried in its entirety, that would certainly cause us to view this project differently.
Well, and glad you raised the burial issue again, John. Here's an email from Al who also says, if you take the $200 million Eversource is using to buy support for this project, plus what they've spent so far fighting burial of the past in the North Country, they'd have near the money they need to have buried it from the start. Al says, duh, bury the first 40. That $200 million that he mentions, Dave Solomon, that's the Forward New Hampshire Fund.
That's the Economic Development Fund that is being used as an incentive to win support for the project, largely in the North Country.
So what do you think about that and your broad thoughts too, Mark Brown, on this issue of to bury or not to bury? A lot of folks say, look, if you just buried it, I wouldn't have a problem with it.
If it becomes uneconomic to bury more of the line and the project doesn't get developed, that would be bad. Keep in mind that there's no project like Northern Pass anywhere in the world that's completely buried. Nowhere. This would be the first time. So it's not – I don't think it's as easy as, you know, people just say, oh, well, let's just bury it. You know, they did reduce the capacity of the line to bury the additional 60 lines through the White Mountain National Forest, you know, which was, I think, seen as a concession. And they just don't feel like they can incur, you know, more expensive burial and still, you know, proceed with the line.
So that would make the whole project more expensive. And at that point, what's the point? That's been their argument for a long time. And an argument sounds like you agree with, Mark.
Yes.
Tom?
Well, I guess, you know, I've heard the argument that this would be precedential in terms of a burial project. But there are other projects involving much greater distances that are buried in their entirety. There's a project that will bring Canadian hydropower to New York. It will be submerged in Lake Champlain, and then it will run along transportation corridors, primarily an active railroad corridor, for 127 miles. So it may be a challenge to bury this project on PSNH's desired route. Our view, and I know it's a view shared by many, is we need to expand the lens and look for additional routes, including the use of transportation corridors, which, as Christine, I believe, mentioned, has been done in Maine and is being done in other projects.
Mark, what about our emailer Al's point that, look, they're putting up $200 million for this economic development fund in the North Country. Why not spend that money burying it? If they've got $200 million to spare, why not use that to bury
the
line?
See the money go back to ratepayers. So, you know, yeah, you know, we don't like the idea of, you know, what's perceived as people withholding support until they're, you know, while their hands are out. So, yeah, we'd rather see the $200 million go back to ratepayers. We're always looking out for ratepayer interest. So,
a couple emails, again, that I want to share with all of you. Here's one from Mike in Manchester. Our region's high and unstable energy costs are consistently cited by businesses across New Hampshire as an impediment to growth and a threat to their long-term ability to stay in New Hampshire, especially manufacturing firms that make up a large portion of our economy. Loss of these manufacturing firms would be crippling to our state's economy. So that's an email from Mike in Manchester. And then here's one from Joseph in Lancaster, who says, 20 years ago, as I completed my PhD as a child psychologist, I could have gone anywhere. He says, I chose Lancaster, New Hampshire because of the way it looked. That's Joseph's emphasis there. He says, if it had ugly towers running through it, I probably wouldn't have. So an email from Mike in favor, saying businesses need lower rates, and an email from Joseph in Lancaster saying, no, he lives in the North Country because it's beautiful. Let's take one more call. This is Joe in Rochester. Hi, Joe. Go ahead. You're on the exchange.
Hi, Laura. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure. Go ahead.
I have a quick comment and then a question for the panelists, if I could. So I'm an electrical worker, and I've done a great deal of research on this project. And one thing that people should understand is the more of this cable that is buried, the less opportunity for New Hampshire workers. There are manufacturing issues with the cable. The manufacturer will oversee the installation. The splicing of, like, every 2,000 feet, you have to have a splice. All that is super intense and specialty work that would have to we would have to import a great deal more of the workforce. We have New Hampshire workers right now, and kids in the business that we want to bring into the business and start to work on this project. Some great opportunities for apprenticeship training programs for the line guys and electricians for the statewide. Some real, real good opportunities.
So from a jobs perspective, Joe, is it better than to keep it the way it's proposed or bury the whole thing, just from your jobs perspective?
For the jobs perspective, for the New Hampshire worker and putting people to work in New Hampshire, we're better off with more of it above ground.
Above ground. Okay.
Because that's what we train, and we have people already that are available and ready to go to work on this process.
So, Joe, you said you had a question for our guests. I'm asking you to jump in real quick with it because we are almost done.
Right. So the question is, part of the proposal is a significant upgrade to the COAS loop, which, from my understanding, has been a stranglehold on the North Country for a number of years. I remember hearing about it about 12 years ago, that they wanted to upgrade that for more energy capacity. And part of this proposal, I understand, is an upgrade for more energy capacity for the North Country.
So another benefit that we haven't even talked about yet. I'm going to turn to Dave Solomon on that. I'm sorry to cut you off. Joe, do you know about this, Dave?
Part of the plan includes construction that would upgrade the transmission capabilities in the North Country, which would also, by the way, set the stage for wind development up there, because you would then have a place to plug it in. So whether you think that's a good thing or a bad thing, that's another possibility.
What do you think, Dave? I'll try and get everybody in on this, but what do you think is the most important thing to know about this project as it moves forward in this site evaluation committee process?
Well, right now there's the possibility of significant additional delay. The project is on track for a decision by December of this year, because it was accepted in December of 2015, and the law says the SEC has a year to decide. But the Council for the Public has filed a motion saying we need at least 6 months more than that. And the SEC could agree to that within the next month or so, which would put approval off possibly into 2020.
Wow, 2020. Tom, last word there for you?
I would say, in addition to that, I would say likely time frame, given the complexity and the number of interveners, there is also at the federal levels significant questions about further analyses that need to be done.
We haven't even talked about the federal level
exactly
yet. We're focused on the site evaluation committee. And Mark, how about you, real quick?
I would say the most important thing is we need the power. We've got like I said earlier, we have 8,000 megawatts of capacity retiring or soon to retire. You can't fill that donut hole with energy efficiency and intermittent renewables without the requisite infrastructure to expand, you know, for natural gas pipeline expansion. We're becoming too reliant on natural gas, so we're going to need large-scale hydro.
All right. We'll close it out there. Thank you all very much. This is The Exchange.